is our brother Ken Stiles. The theme for Brother Stiles' classes this week is God Delivers His People from the Sentence of Death, a Study of Esther. Today's class title is A Rebellious Queen. Brother Ken.
There's a handout, brethren and sisters, friends and young people, for the classes for this week in our study of Esther. I think you'll find it covers most of the significant points and the comments that will be made throughout the week. So you have the option of either following along in the handout, and I may refer to it periodically, or just setting it aside and sitting back and entering in to this time period in the life of the Jews in which God is able to accomplish great things and at the same time teach us how he can deliver us from the power of death. Because we'll see in our studies this week that the same principles, the same methodology, in some cases the exact same events that occur for the salvation of the redeemed of all ages are taking place in the book of Esther. This week we want to walk with Mordecai and Esther and be there with them as they face their trials and the decisions and how they commit themselves to risking their life for the sake of their people and the final joy and celebration that we see in the last few chapters. And the book is written in a way that invites us as the readers to live through these events, to place ourselves there. In chapter 1, to see the enormous feast that King Ahasuerus holds for the empire and then the city of Shushan. And to be with Esther as she appeals to the king in chapter 4 for the sake of her, in chapter 5 for the sake of her people. It's a great story, really, for any age. Any of us that have been involved in teaching Sunday school know that it portrays dramatic events surrounding the Jews' deliverance. It's a fairy tale of sorts from the world's perspective. Because here is this young Jewish maiden who's an orphan, and she grows up to become queen of the world. Remarkable events. God is at work in each one of them. There's a villain, the bad guy, the one who seeks to destroy all the Jews. And in the end, he'll be hanged for his wicked deeds. And there's the hero, who is the first to stand up and oppose the villain. And he will rise to become the second in command. The drama is nothing short of breathtaking in the book. And it's written in such a way that we almost have to put the pieces, the different events that are happening, in some cases simultaneously together, to get a full picture of what is taking place in Shushan. Because there's an awful lot of activity, as we see, and an awful lot of events that are going to take place in a very compressed period of time. We will stand with Esther as she takes her life in her hands. She rises that day when she appeals to the king, and she doesn't know if this will be the end of her life. And within the next 24 hours, incredible events will take place. And the Jews will go from being in a position of condemnation to exaltation as a result of her faithful obedience under the leadership and the guiding hand of her cousin Mordecai. But we'll also need to see beyond the stories and be able to identify the spiritual principles that are at work in the lives of these faithful men and women. And to see beyond the principles as they apply to our life and look for examples of where these principles can apply in our own day, in our own lives, and in our families and ecclesias. For instance, the storyline of Esther describes how the Jews unite to slay their enemies before the book is concluded. But the spiritual principle of salvation is not automatic. If you were alive in those days and a Jew, and you didn't participate in the slaying of your enemies, you were killed. And there's a principle that God is teaching us there, that salvation does not come automatically. We still have a part to play. The Lord Jesus Christ has opened the door of salvation to us, but there is still a battle that must be fought by each of us.
And husbands can't fight the battle for their wives, and wives can't fight the battle for their husbands, and parents can't fight the battle for their children. Each person has to be fully engaged. We'll also see parables and types in the book of Esther, and don't be afraid to recognize the parables and the types in the book of Esther, because it's a major part of God's message to us in this book. It's a parable of how God redeems all of us from the law of sin and death and frees us from sin's domination in our life. At times we can adopt the attitude or the frame of mind that says, well, sin will always be with me. And so the purpose of the truth is simply for me to continually ask God for forgiveness, and then I go back into a way of life in which sin is once more dominating my actions. That is not why Jesus died on the cross. That is not the way of life that God is intending to bring us to. He really, literally, can break sin's domination of our life so that we are no longer enslaved to it. And that's what he intends his word to lead us to in our discipleship. And we're going to see a vivid example of how that is portrayed in the book of Esther. An entire race of people had come under the law of condemnation, and they were going to die. But the enemy, who initiated all, is eventually defeated by the faithful obedience of a single man who the enemy had singled out to be put to death. And therein we'll see in the book the two stages of deliverance. Number one is the death of the enemy concentrated in a single man, in this case in Haman. And then secondly, the battle that each must still fight in order to gain the salvation that was secured by the Savior. There are also in the book tremendous lessons for the Gentiles, for the remnant living in Gentile times. This period of time in Israel's history, whether it's the book of Ezra or Nehemiah or Esther, is an excellent study for us, because this is a case in history where the remnant in the Old Testament were living in times surrounded by an overwhelming Gentile influence, and how they responded to the pressures they faced, how they handled the antagonism of the Gentiles around them, the attractions that the Gentiles offered, the trials that arise when the truth needs to coexist in a society dominated by a Gentile influence. That there are lessons for us in how to maintain our discipleship and how our faith can grow even under the pressure of Gentile domination. An example of which is Mordecai understood how to balance between loyal service and employee and where to draw the line. Because in one case, he can risk his life to save his boss's life in chapter 2, but then turn around in chapter 3 and disobey his boss. Disobey the king's command to bow down to Haman. Because he understood there's a line that each of us who are involved in employment must draw. That each of us who are engaged in the world in whatever capacity must draw between being faithful employees and yet being faithful to the God we serve. There are practical lessons throughout the book. We'll see that the power of spiritual counseling. When Mordecai addresses Esther and brings her in a marvelous development of her faith, all from a distance, her character will be transformed by the counseling of Mordecai. We'll see the power of unity at work in this book, as the ecclesia is brought together to work for the common good, united in their prayers and pleadings to God for their deliverance. We may have come to Bible school this week with our personal faith under attack, under a Haman-like attack, in which we are faced with a situation where it doesn't appear to have any resolution in our favor. The pressures of life are such, whether it be with our children, it may be a health problem that we're struggling with, it may be a broken relationship in our life, it may be unbearable conditions at work, it may be a loss of work. But none of us face the kind of conditions in total that the Jews faced, because they were living under a law that said, on this day you will all die. And how they respond to that and how we should respond to the trials that we face in life
can be very educational for us. There's an unusual aspect in the book of Esther. There is no mention, as most of us probably are aware, of God, of prayer, of religious worship, or the law of Moses. You won't find any references. We don't know for certain why that's the case, but the indication seems to be that the book is challenging us. It's encouraging us. It's teaching us to see the hand of God at work in our life. So when we put the events of the book of Esther together, it's unmistakable that God is at work in these events, because each person is doing their part individually, and God is able to take these individual pieces and put them together in such a way that he can bring deliverance to his people. There will be great acts of faith on the part of these individuals, but we won't find the word faith mentioned in the book. You see, the remnant living in Gentile times, in the days of Ezra and Esther and Nehemiah, didn't have the Holy Spirit. They didn't have prophets. They didn't have angelic visitations, much like our own day. They simply had the Word to know and understand and to trust Him. And in that respect, our belief is like their belief, because it rests solely upon faith. And our ability to read and understand the Word and how God has revealed Himself in it. And secondly, our belief rests in the fact that our ability to understand the events in our life and how God is working in our life. Critical that disciples be able to see the hand of God at work in their life so that they can appreciate the difficulties for the spiritual value that they bring. God wants us to see Him at work in our life, to see Him as a reality in the joys as well as the sorrows. In the prosperity and as well as the adversity, and when we're in safety or when we're in danger, because He responds to our prayers, He responds to our pleadings, He responds to when we agonize, and our life trials brings us to the point of agonizing over trying to remain faithful to Him in the face of significant challenges that we face. But if we fail to see God at work in our life, as Esther saw God at work in her life, as Mordecai taught Esther to see God at work in her life, we will fail to come to the point where Mordecai is able to teach Esther and to instruct her that these things have happened because God is working with us. And if we respond faithfully, God can use us. If we don't respond faithfully, God will have to work through someone else. And it was on the strength of Esther being able to recognize that God was at work in her life for her good, that she was able to undertake the faithful obedience that she does in pursuing deliverance for her people. The time frame of the book of Esther we have outlined in the handout. We're not going to spend any time on it this morning. If you're interested in where it fits in, we've given you some of the details. Basically, if we were to take the book of Esther and interject it into the book of Ezra, our recommendation would be to place it at the between the end of chapter 6 of the book of Ezra and before the beginning of chapter 7. What's happening in Palestine is the temple has been rebuilt under the efforts of Jeshua and Zerubbabel and the guiding and counseling hand of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah. And then the book of Esther likely occurs. And following the book of Esther will be the work of Ezra and King Artaxerxes, sending him back to the land to help the community there from a spiritual standpoint. And then Nehemiah's work would take place subsequent to that. We cannot be certain of where Esther belongs. In fact, most commentaries, historians, would place the book of Esther later on after the work of Nehemiah. But if you look at the story of the Bible, for instance, there's excellent proof to establish the fact that Artaxerxes and Ahasuerus are all titles for kings.
So when we read of King Artaxerxes and King Ahasuerus, they aren't necessarily different individuals. But regardless of which Persian king is on the throne, a couple things emerge. One is that Mordecai is an old man in the book of Esther. If you look on the chart there, we know he was born before the captivity, because it alludes to that in chapter 2 at verse 6. And then you have the period of captivity, the 70 years, and then you have a subsequent period after the Jews returned, and then you have this king, either Hystaspes or Longimanus, and it's either an additional 25 or 55 years. So Mordecai is at least 90 when he becomes the prime minister of Persia, and it's possible he's 126. So he's an old man in terms of age. He's either in his early 80s when the book opens, or he's in the mid-teens of his second century. But like Ezra, who also was either 90 or potentially 126, depending on which king he lived under, which Persian king. Remember what Brother Peter alluded to yesterday, how when he took the platform in Nehemiah chapter 8, and he was pivotal in bringing about the spiritual reformation of the nation. Nehemiah's work had taken place to physically bring about a point of separation with the Gentile influence. And then Nehemiah hands the torch over to Ezra. And Ezra will now spiritually guide the nation in this, in the reformation, because their hearts still needed to change. Ezra is at least 90 years old when he ascends the wooden pulpit that day. And the greatest work in his life, like the greatest work of Mordecai, is taking place in the last years of his life. Tremendous exhortation to our own brethren and sisters. Sometimes God will wait until our last years when we need to make our most significant contribution to the ecclesias. We ought not be distancing ourselves from the important decisions of the ecclesia and the important aspects of ecclesial life. Unlike the world's wisdom that says when a brother or a man gets to the age of 60 or 70, the best years of his life have passed on. Regardless of which king, if you take a look at number 4 on the handout, regardless of which king, Persian king, is on the throne, you'll notice there's a commonality, a common denominator in all of these relationships with the faithful Jewish leaders and these Persian and Babylonian kings. And the common element is that they are showing unusual kindness and consideration and compassion to God's people. So whether it's Nebuchadnezzar treating Jeremiah better than Jeremiah's own countrymen treated him, or Nebuchadnezzar showing favoritism to Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego and elevating each of them to the top governmental positions, or it's Cyrus doing the same for Daniel, the Babylonian kingdom is replaced by the Persian kingdom, and this Jew goes from prime minister of one to prime minister of the other. Another example of how God is at work in the lives of his people. The same issue with Cyrus and restoring calling for the temple to rebuild and encouraging Jeshua and Zerubbabel. And Cyrus will also support, or rather Darius will also support Jeshua and Zerubbabel, we know from the book of Ezra, in terms of having the temple completed after that was challenged for a period of time by the Gentiles. Ezra returns to the land, and the king says, when you go back, my decree is, if the Jews do not keep the law of Moses, they are to be destroyed. That's the kind of support Ezra had when you read through the 7th chapter of Ezra. Nehemiah shows up in chapter 2 of Nehemiah, and he has in his pocket royal decrees that authorize him to use whatever means and whatever support is necessary from the king's treasury to rebuild the walls. Tremendous examples of how God is at work in the lives of his people, even through the Gentile powers around them. And it's great comfort for us, because God, we know, is at work in the lives of the political leaders of the world today. But most of us don't have much to do with President Bush on a day-to-day basis, or Prime Minister Chrétien. We have a lot to do with our boss, a Gentile who is over us. And you see, God is at work in the lives of our bosses and our supervisors and our colleagues in the exact same way that he was at work in the lives of the Gentiles affecting the Jews during this time period, for good or for bad in terms of temporary situations. It won't always be a pocket full of royal edicts that lets us do what we want to do and the king will pay for it. But even in difficult times, as we will see in the book of Esther, God is at work in those situations, and he's at work in the lives of those people. So if we have a boss, or we have colleagues, or we have fellow students or teachers, whatever our situation may be, and they are making our life unbearable, it isn't outside the scope of God's involvement. The other thing we should note before we leave these faithful Jews that were contemporary at the time of Esther, is that each of these also shared a common denominator. If you look at Ezra, Nehemiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, his three friends, Joshua, Zerubbabel, they all shared the common denominator of making a public stand for their allegiance to Yahweh. And they told the Gentiles around them that first and foremost, we are servants of the God of heaven, and everything else in our life is of secondary importance. And it is a critical public declaration to make, brethren and sisters, and friends and young people, when we are the remnant attempting to live in a Gentile-dominated world. Because once we make that personal public commitment and declaration, God can do wonderful things in our life, as he did wonderful things in the lives of these faithful remnant believers. Until we make that declaration, we almost tie God's hands. Because the Gentiles around us see this strange way of life that we adopt. But if they don't understand what's behind it, all it does is confuse them. And nor is it of any value to make our public declaration of being servants of Yahweh and then turn around and live exactly like they do. But it's a significant lesson for each of us living in Gentile times. In the book of Esther, we'll need to get below the surface. For instance, if we turn over to chapter 1. The events of chapter 1, in which the king holds a feast. First of all, he holds a six-month feast in which he invites the army, the leaders of the army, into the empire. On the surface, it reads as if we're dealing with a proud, boastful king who is showing off. First, he's showing off his empire, and then at the end, he will show off his wife. In the midst of a drunken feast, he will call for her to come in, put her on public display, and we can sympathize and understand why she refuses. He has surrounded himself with men of ill repute, chauvinistic, to use the term of the last 30 or 40 years, and they will advise the king, well, you need to get rid of this wife, and you need to find another one. So in a drunken rage, he will, as a dictatorial tyrant might, he will call for her to be removed and call for another queen to be found. And if we're not careful, and we read through these events on the surface, as we've just described, our sympathies can end up residing with Vashti and think that it was quite understandable. And she was, right within her own means of properly refusing to appear before the king. But take a look, for instance, at the handout on number 5. The way that Ahasuerus is presented in chapter 1. He's presented as a benevolent ruler who sought to publicly celebrate the empire's achievements. And notice his characteristics. He's generous. He invites all of the leading men of the army in for this six-month feast. And then during the second feast, he will open the doors of the palace in Shushan and will treat all of the citizenry in Shushan to a one-week royal feast. And the royal wine will flow. But it isn't mandatory, because this king is not only generous, he's also sensitive and shows consideration to the consciences of the people that come into the feast. So he gives specific orders to the officials in chapter 1 that no one should be compelled to drink. We also see that he showed no partiality. Both the small and the great were invited to the feast. He didn't say, just bring in the rich ones. He said, bring everybody in. Let them all enjoy the beauty of the king's palace and to drink the royal wine from the golden goblets and to sit on the golden couches. He respected the laws of the Persian society. This is not a drunken feast that is taking place in chapter 1. The women are not even there. The women are off having their own feast with Vashti. So any thoughts that this was just an immoral feast of 7 days hosted by some ungodly man need to be replaced by how the scriptures portray Ahasuerus. He's a law-abiding individual who instinctively knows to consult the law when Vashti rebels, as she does. And he will seek justice from the law and turning to the counselors. He won't act out of anger. He has surrounded himself with men who know the law, men whom he relies upon to make sure he's acting within the confines of the Persian law. And he has the type of character that Vashti feels, thinks, she can rebel against and get away with it. If he was a tyrant who is likely to go off into fits of rage, she would not pick the time she did. We're not suggesting for a moment that he is a God-fearing man. But we do know the impact that Daniel had on Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel was in the Persian kingdom for quite some time. And they would have learned about his God who saves him out of adversity, who can close the mouths of lions. These Persian kings were not fools. They knew that they were dealing with a God of Israel who is an amazing God. It's one of the reasons that Haman does not reveal to the king in chapter 3 who the people are that he's going to destroy. So we're not portraying Ahasuerus as a God-fearing man or in any way inferring that he was part of the structure of the truth. But we're going to see later on in the book that God will use Ahasuerus to portray his position, God's position in the events and in the enactment of the parables that take place. So it's important to realize from chapter 1 that he has a law-abiding character and he appreciates the righteous characteristics of others. Vashti's rebellion is nothing short of treason. And the reason she rebelled against her husband was she was specifically attacking the need for herself to treat her husband as her head. She wanted all to see that she no longer considered Ahasuerus as her lord. And the proof of that is when Ahasuerus and the seven counselors assemble to figure out what law we need to undo what she has done, the law they come up with is one that will restore the honor of the husbands in the homes of the Persian households. Because it was the honor of the husbands that Vashti had attacked. The purpose of the feast, we read in verse 4, was to show the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his majesty, as it is in the RSV, which is what I'll be referring to this week. In the authorized version, it says it was to show the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty. So that was the purpose of the feast that the king had called for, to publicly display the honor and the majesty and the glory of the empire. And there are lavish settings, if we were to take the time to read through them, with the colorful hangings and the pavement and the gold vessels and the gold couches and the abundance of wine. See, the king is not showing off. He is celebrating the wonder of the empire. If this, in fact, is Darius Hystaspes, as we've recommended, he would have been involved in wars in the first 3 years of his life. And now that he has beaten down his enemies, in the third year, when this takes place, he's able to now open the kingdom up, open the palace up. And there's a respite from battle. And so he is sharing with the nation and with the army the wonders and the splendors of the kingdom. It is not a Belshazzar back in Daniel 5 who gets the people together to have a drunken feast and blaspheme the God of Israel who sees the handwriting on the wall. It's a sharp contrast between that feast and the feast we read of here. He's not trying to make, when he calls Vashti to come before him in all her glory, arrayed in her royal robes with her crown upon her head. He's not trying to make her a public spectacle, but she is very much a part of the majesty of this empire. The vessels and the hangings and the marble columns were not displayed to show their individual beauty, but collectively, this is what the empire stood for. And they were a reflection of the empire's achievement. And the majesty of the kingdom would not have been complete without the queen. It was fitting that she not be there during the 7 days, because the men were having their feast and the women were having their own separate feast. The king was not interested in intermingling the two. But here on the 7th day, it was quite fitting that she be brought in. There was also a second purpose of the feast. For those of us that live under a republic, we may not fully appreciate this. But the feasts were also to promote goodwill and right living and loyal service by the army and by the people, both to the king and to the throne and to the empire. And Vashti has a key role to play in support of her husband's efforts to promote the honoring of the king and the honoring of the empire. We mentioned before that when it says the king's heart was merry with wine, he's not drunk. If you take a look in chapter 5 at verse 9, you'll find the exact same Hebrew words describe Haman as he's leaving the first banquet. Esther did not get Haman drunk at the first banquet or the king. She very much wanted to maintain an environment in which both of them would understand what was happening in these banquets. His first reaction, as we've mentioned, when he finds out that she has rebelled against him, is to turn right to the law and turn to his counselors and to seek their advice. And he turns to them and asks them, after she's rebelled, what does the law say we should do? What is best for the people? That is not typical of a man who is enraged. That is reflective of a man who has his wits about him and who is thinking, now how should we act to deal with this, but act in a way that is in accordance with the law and that will be best for the empire? You see, what he's done is, on the 7th day, he was going to make her the centerpiece of the celebration. Vashti's appearance at the second feast, on the 7th day of the second feast, would be the grand finale of a week-long period of celebration of the nation's greatness. And she picked that time to rebel against him and to show her disdain. The piece we don't fully appreciate living in a republic is that there is an element of the throne that is intended to impact on how people live. If we were all British subjects, we would have a greater appreciation of this. How the king or queen conduct themselves has a critical impact on the social fabric of society. And it's important under the spiritual principle. This isn't a British principle or a principle of the monarch. It's a godly principle. When those who are in positions of responsibility and authority act properly, it has a positive effect on all those who come under their influence and under their authority. Conversely, when the throne is brought into disrepute or shame, it can have a similar effect, only the other way, upon all the subjects. And that became the key issue of Vashti's rebellion. Her challenging of the king, it says in verse 16, is going to reverberate throughout the empire. Mamukin said, in the presence of the king and the princes, not only to the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also to all the princes and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. So he recognized that what she had done was going to attack the moral fabric of the Persian society. And it's no coincidence that she has picked this precise time at the height of the king's feast to show her disdain for the king. And she would have come in as the leading woman of Persian society because she's been holding her own feast for all the women in her own area of the king's house. And now she's brought in as the leading woman of the empire, and her actions are going to immediately send a signal to the wives throughout the empire. She sends word that she will not comply in a very visible and a very public manner. And to those women who are looking to be out from underneath the responsibility of their husbands, she would have been a hero. In verse 17, it says that she despised, or in the RSV, she showed contempt for her husband. And as a result, it would cause the other women to look with contempt upon their own husbands. And the word means to disesteem, to have no value. It's the same word that is used to describe Esau and how he disesteemed his birthright. She knew exactly what she was doing. She knew what her responsibilities were under the royal protocol. And it would be no different today if the wife of the president or the wife of the prime minister went on national TV and told everyone, I am no longer going to honor my husband. The effects would be tremendous, even if we do live in a republic. The fact in verse 18, where Mamukin makes the observation that this very day shows that there would be an immediate impact and of great magnitude throughout the empire. So it isn't the king's ego that's at stake in chapter 1. It's the harmony of every household in the empire. And it's important to recognize who will generate the contempt and who will generate the wrath in verse 18 when he goes on to say that this very day the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will be telling it to all the king's princes, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. So when the wives of the Persians hear about this, they will show similar contempt. If that's how the queen can teach the king, well, there's a model for us. And the wrath will come from the husbands. As we see in verse 12, this is how Ahasuerus reacted to Vashti's rebellion. So what we're going to have, Mamukin observes, in every household is wives showing contempt or despising their husbands and the husbands responding in wrath. And domestic upheaval would overwhelm the empire, which is why they take immediate steps to pass a law to restore the importance of the husband's position within the empire. Now, if the Persians could understand the importance of the husband's being the head of the household. You see, their actions in passing the law in verse 20, it says, so when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, vast as it is, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low. And they passed the law in verse 22 that every man should be lord in his own house. Imagine today the president and Congress getting together and passing that kind of law. They would never do it. And yet the actions of the Persians' officials are in complete harmony with the principles that we find in Scripture about the husband being the head of the household, whether it be in Ephesians 5 or 1 Corinthians 11, Colossians 3, and the other places. They understood that this principle needed to be upheld in each home. And certainly, brethren and sisters, and young people and friends, if the Persians could understand this, isn't it that much more critical that we be able to understand this principle and that we be able to see the benefit, because we have the added benefit of appreciating the spiritual reasons for this. The idea of the wives submitting to their husbands goes right back to creation, as Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 2. God made Adam differently than he made Eve. And he made Adam in a way that he would bear responsibility and authority for his household. And he made Eve of a different nature. Not a physical nature, but a different disposition. She has different strengths than Adam. And in God's wisdom, God turns to wives and says, look, if you disregard your husband being your head, and you disregard my wisdom in this matter, then you're going to end up like Eve. And that's the situation that you're going to find yourselves in. But there's a natural resentment in any relationship when one person is asked to submit to another. It's why the Bible teaches us that we all need to learn to submit to one another, whether it's wives to husbands, whether it's servants to masters, whether it's children to parents, whether it's ecclesial members to their elders. When we submit to one another, we learn to rid ourselves of self-importance, and we learn to become a godly servant. But Vashti's contempt for her husband was not unique just to her. Wives in every relationship in which they need to submit themselves to their husbands can fall victim to the thinking of Vashti. And it's especially difficult when a wife sees her husband, the one that she is supposed to submit to, fail miserably in his responsibility. And we're not talking now about adultery or some other grievous sin against her, but in the everyday matters. When a wife sees her husband use poor judgment and make bad decisions that affect the family, either emotionally or financially, or she sees her husband display a low level of spirituality in the home or in the ecclesial environment, or he shows little interest in the kids, that's when her esteem for her husband will be challenged. Now, if her esteem for her husband is rooted in his conduct, he will inevitably let her down. And that's why God asks wives not to submit yourself to your husbands because of his conduct or contingent upon his conduct, but submit to your husbands by faith. Trust me, God says, that if you follow what I have designed and you submit yourself to your husband by faith, not just on the days when he's doing the right things and not have to submit to him on the days when he's doing the wrong things, but if you submit to him by faith and trust me, good things can happen for you, eternal things. And our time is gone today, but when we begin tomorrow, we'll take a look at the flip side, because the message to husbands is equally as powerful. If we are simply loving our wives on those days when she's being a model wife or a model mother for our kids or a model helpmeet, and we are not loving our wives out of faith, the same problems can develop. But we'll leave it there and pick it up, Lord willing, tomorrow.